In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Not to throw jargon at you, but there's a marketing and pricing technique called hyperbolic discounting. Hyperbolic discounting is a psychological effect where people value the immediacy of time over money. It's a psychological preference for an immediate reward rather than a delayed reward, even if the immediate reward is smaller than the one offered later. For example, people would rather have $10 right now than $20 later. It's a cognitive bias ingrained in us as human beings. The real trick, though, from a marketing and pricing perspective, is to find the right combination of perceived value versus time. Getting back to that example, if I said I'd give you $10 now or $20 in 5 minutes, of course you'd be happy to wait 5 minutes. But if I said I'll give you $10 now or $20 in 6 months from now, most people will opt for the now. And that's the trick. As the delay gap widens, the more people are likely to take today's gains over some future reward, even though the actual value is constant. Now, increase the delayed reward to, say, $1,000, and you can see how your perception would change yet again. Now, there's a lot more to it here, but you can see how people can be manipulated into perceiving the value you want them to believe is there. And it's this and other marketing gimmicks and psychological tricks that I often think of when I think of the appeal of socialism. Who doesn't like free stuff? Free healthcare, free tuition, and all the rest. Free college now versus having to pay for it later. Not to mention paying the tuition of everyone around you for the rest of your life. Except the perception is, you never have to pay for it. Socialism is the ultimate terms and conditions apply. So on today's show, we're talking about what the Republicans ought to be talking about, their opponents, rather than giving people reasons not to vote for their fellow Republicans. To do that, we thought we'd visit with someone who's not only lived through socialism, but someone who's taught about it and written about it, Dr. Tim Ball. Dr. Tim, it's always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you know, I think it's a little embarrassing sometimes that Canada is our neighbor to the north, and obviously has been for a very long time, and is a very good friend to the United States. But a lot of people really don't know that much about Canada's government, or certainly not as much as Canadians seem to know about America. So I'd like to kind of dive in on with our discussion of socialism with a little bit of history, but actually I'd like to start with some personal history, because you were actually not born in Canada. You were born over in the UK. And so why don't you go ahead and start this discussion from there, and because that was kind of your first experiences was with socialism.
With socialism, yeah. I was born near Stonehenge, and so whenever it said on the government form religion, I always put Druid. And nobody's ever questioned that. I just have fear of people in white sheets showing up looking for money for oak trees. But one of the things that happened in Britain after the war, and there are several stories that I can relate to that because I was born before the war, and we had German prisoners of war working for us during the war, and that was very interesting as well. But Britain got rid of Winston Churchill within 3 months of the end of the war.
Yes.
And generally, the view of Churchill was far higher outside of Britain than it was amongst a lot of English people, partly because he switched political ships a couple of times. He went from being a conservative to a liberal and then back to conservative again. And people, of course, during the war had become accustomed to the government controlling everything. I mean, for example, we were allowed one egg per child per week. My mother had a coupon book in which she had to have enough coupons in order to be to buy a new coat, and she was only allowed one new coat every 2 years or something. So you had a situation where people sacrificed totally their personal rights and freedoms in order to fight the war. The problem is a lot of people became accustomed to that, And then after the war, the socialist government of Clement Attlee came in, and by the way, just to give you Churchill's view of him, somebody once said that Attlee was a very humble man, and Churchill said, yes, he's got lots to be humble about. And of course, he then saw that opportunity of not giving things back to the people and started the whole socialist trend, which included a national education and also a national health system and as I said, nationalized the railways, transportation systems.
And were the seeds of that already in existence prior to the war?
No, not really. No, and that's part of the problem today, because since the war, now America, Canada, or the government took over a lot of things, America not quite as much, but you've now got generations that can't even imagine very little government. It's just simply beyond their comprehension. And so to roll that back, they can't think about it, but it also scares them. And, of course, so by 1957, I saw that I was going nowhere, that Britain was going nowhere. There was unemployment, massive unemployment, fights between the unions, particularly the coal miners union, going out on strike all of the time. So I just said, no, I need a more open future and greater potential. So in those days, I was lucky, I just simply jumped on a plane and flew to Canada, and that was it. And that was allowed because, of course, Canada at that time was part of the Commonwealth, and therefore, if you were a Commonwealth or British, you could simply travel. But I saw the effects of that growing socialism on England, and of course, there's still that struggle that goes on now. People trying to Tony Blair, for example, he created a new form of socialism, but really it was the old socialism. They just tried to trick people into thinking that they would not have as much government control as they were going to have. But that's the same thing. It's like with Obama. If people really listened to Obama and looked at his background, when he talked about change, you knew what he meant by change. The problem is he didn't push it too hard, and the few people that questioned it, I mean, Glenn Beck is a perfect example. Glenn Beck knew exactly what he was doing. Now you've got Rubio saying, you know, he's achieving all of his goals. Well, that's completely contrary to people saying, well, you know, he's incompetent. No, he isn't. These people know exactly what they're doing when they take over. And so, of course, I came to Canada and watched the gradual socialism encroachment in Canada. And it's just with the election of our latest Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, we're pretty far to the left.
Yes,
but you've got to. One of the jokes I like about, you know, why did the Canadian cross the road? And the answer is to get to the middle. Okay, and what's interesting about that joke is that to an American, that's an insult. A Canadian just shrugs his shoulders and says, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, that's the epitome, yeah. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right there, actually. I'd like to come back and talk to you a little bit more about some of the conditions there in Europe, especially the fact that Hitler himself was a socialist. Everyone stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, helping you to keep an eye on big government. And to do that, we're talking with Dr. Tim Ball, a retired professor from the University of Manitoba, that's in Winnipeg. He has an extensive authorship with more than 50 articles and multiple peer-reviewed journals, as well as 3 books. Talking to him today about socialism, having lived through Canada's occasional bouts of socialist fervor. Before the break, though, we were talking about the conditions there in Europe and your own experiences coming out of the UK. And one of the things that a lot of people don't quite understand is that Hitler, he's often portrayed, especially by people on the left, that he was this far right-wing, kind of ultra-conservative person, and they're trying to, of course, demonize conservatives out of this, but actually he was a socialist, wasn't he?
he was a total socialist. And of course, the word Nazi means National Socialist. And one of the things that that's parallel throughout socialism is that they control the people, and then the corporations crony to them. So crony capitalism was practiced in Hitler's regime. For example, I will not buy Hugo Boss clothing because Hugo Boss designed the Nazi SS uniforms.
Wow.
Right? And so you, when you start to, and then the Krupp organization and so on, of course, Volkswagen, designed by Porsche, Dr. Porsche, mm-hmm. who was a great favorite of Hitler's. And so you see that corporate and socialist connection, and it appears like a contradiction, but it really isn't, because if you look at the powerful left in the corporate world, like George Soros, for example, who, of course, came out of Hungary pre-war and lived through that whole Nazi regime. In fact, the stories are that he was actually helping the Nazis by reporting Jewish landowners, and then when they kicked him out, he bought the land. But, I mean, Hitler was all about a total state control of everything. And as I said, then all of that funded by the crony capitalism of the German industry. Now, the battle, of course, ironically, was between Hitler and Stalin and communism.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's why people tend to think of Hitler as the fascist right wing, because he was fighting the communists.
Yeah.
And when you look at Britain prior to the war, that was the great battle, was between the aristocrats and the right wing, and then the Bloomsbury Group, Virginia Woolf, and all of that, who were communist supporters. But then you had Oswald Mosley, who was married to one of the Mitford girls, and he had his own black shirt Nazi regime in Britain. Mm. So it was a very, very confused political picture with people on the left and the right. But as I said, when you've got Hitler going as a left-wing fascist tackling the communists who are left-wing or socialist, it shows how confused it actually was.
Yeah, well, you know, there's really no difference between Nazism and socialism and communism. It's really just the different, you know, what exactly they're controlling and how much of a control they have over it. And so I agree with you that yeah. Hitler was very much a socialist. You know, Europe seems to be able to embrace socialism a little bit more than here on the other side of the Atlantic. Do you think some of that has to do with the fact that, generationally speaking, they have gotten used to having a king or a queen in charge, and from which all of the good things come, is that, you know, you are given land from the king or queen, you are allowed to do these types of things. And so they're kind of used to a form of socialism in a way.
Well, but of course, again, it was socialism at the upper level, the landowner level.
Right.
You see, for example, and by the way, I also taught a course in political geography for 25 years at the university. So I'm not just talking about this as a personal interest. I actually taught it because mm-hmm. what I was interested in was the impact of climate change on the human condition. And that, of course, meant how it affected nations and nation states and so on. Mm-hmm. And the great myth, as far as I'm concerned, is that Magna Carta was about the rights of the individual. It had nothing to do with that at all. Magna Carta was the 12 or 13 major Norman landholders given land by William the Conqueror in 1066. So they basically divided up England amongst them. And the most powerful of that group became the king. And of course, when the king, John in that case, wasn't doing what those landowners wanted, they said, hey, we're going to have a meeting. And it was done at Runnymede on the banks of the Thames River in 1215, and they forced him to agree to let them keep their land in control as they had always done. By the way, my favorite joke about Magna Carta was the tourist who went there and said, when was this Magna Carta signed anyway? And the tour guide said 12:15, and the guy said, golly, missed it by 20 minutes. Historical jokes. But anyway, so the Magna Carta, as I said, the concept that it was about individual freedoms or rights of the individual. Now, one of the things that people need to think about is the transition in Europe, and it was primarily in Europe that it went on. You think about, for example, Attila the Hun. Where did he live? What was his territory? Now, people have no idea. The group, the nation, was identified by its leader, not by the state that it occupied. Hmm. Now, that changed in England following Magna Carta and through the transition, because by Elizabeth's time, it's Elizabeth of England. Right? And you've gone then from being identified by the national group by being identified as a nation state. And the term that came in with that was dominium. So, and one of the things that happened with the British Empire, by the way, was they looked at their colonies and they decided which ones will be suitable for Englishmen to inhabit and live and control. They let them become dominions. The rest remained colonies. Hmm. Right? So you have the Dominion of Canada. So it had a degree of autonomy, but only if the white guys were running it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, right. So all of these transitions from the nation to the nation state were going on in Europe all the time, and of course the idea that the people represented the power was always an underlying theme throughout Europe. And one of the things that I've studied a great deal is what would cause people to get rid of bad leaders in the form of... go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, let's go ahead and pick that up on the other side of the break because we're running a little bit long here. So everyone stay with us. We'll come back on that with Dr. Tim Ball. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about socialism. And to do that, we're talking with Dr. Tim Ball. He's a retired professor from the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. He has extensive authorship with more than 50 articles and multiple peer-reviewed journals, and as well as three books. In addition, he also taught a course on politics up there. And you know, going into the break there, you're talking about you had wanted to do a study in terms of why people would get rid of these bad leaders. So why don't we pick it up from there?
Yeah, in other words, how much bad leadership has got to occur? Now, one of the things I did was took seniors on tours of Europe for about 20 years, and on three different occasions I took them to Pompeii, and one of the trips we did was just looking at the graffiti, and it was interesting because just prior to the eruption of Vesuvius, there was an election going on, and one of the pieces of graffiti says, if we get rid of this bunch of scoundrels, we just get another bunch of scoundrels. Hmm. And of course,
amazing how politics really doesn't change that much over thousands of years.
Yeah, because what it is it's about the fact that there are leaders and there are followers.
Sure.
Exactly right.
And what you're doing is you're giving somebody else control over you.
Exactly. But that's the key. Now, Robert Ardrey wrote a book called The Social Contract, which, of course, is the same name as the book of Rousseau, and the whole idea about leadership and communing with and relating to nation, how people operate. But what happens is that you allow the leaders to be the leaders, knowing that they're never going to be any good. I mean, that discussion came up on Limbaugh the other day where he got criticized for saying there are no perfect leaders. Well, of course there are not perfect leaders. And what happens in these elections is you keep digging till you find a flaw and throw the whole person out because you found one fault with them. And so what happens throughout history, there are two reasons why people will rise up and throw out the leadership. And just think about, for example, the French Revolution. The hostility between the peasants and the aristocracy was always there. it's still there today. What people don't realize, for example, France had the revolution, but in order to become the prime minister of France, Giscard d'Estaing bought that name. Why did he buy that name? Because it had the letter D in the middle of it, an abbreviated d'Estaing, like Charles de Gaulle. Well, in France, if you have a de in your name, that means you're aristocracy. Right, that you owned land, that you were a landowner. And what happens is that the people will tolerate bad leadership until either the food supply fails, which is what triggered the French Revolution, or the leader starts to believe that they are there because of some power. If they're not there at the will of the people. And so when Charles I, and of course that really starts, and that's the beginning of the whole trigger to the American Revolution, when Charles I said, divine right of kings, I'm put here by God, I'm not here put here by the people, they chopped his head off, right? And when Louis XVI said, l'état c'est moi, I am the state, they chopped his head off too, okay? And of course, what follows that is there's a brief sort of chaos for a while. In England, you had Oliver Cromwell took over. Then he got into the problem, well, who replaces him? And then it got into dynastics and so on. Those were the things that the American Revolution were grappling with, because the real ideas and thoughts of the American Revolution came from ordinary British people and the thoughts of the ordinary British people. But that was the first time in history that they had had a chance to enshrine them in their own state and in their own constitution. And of course, the founding fathers and their wisdom is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
I think that revolution is still going on. But anyway, the idea of revolution getting rid of the leadership. For example, you've got the situations going on in Europe right now. Countries that were former satellites of the Soviet Union, what happened was the communist leaders simply changed their names to Democrats and kept power.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Virtually nothing changed. And by the way,
and now we have the reverse here in the United States, where rather than reverse, the parallel, I should say,
yes.
Here in the United States, where we again have the socialists and communists just claiming they're Democrats.
Exactly. By the way, what they've just got a situation in one of the countries where the first election they had was the guy said, if I'm elected, I'm going to declare myself president for life. And he did.
Mm.
And how can you argue? It was done democratically. Right? And,
wow.
And luckily for the people, he 1996 that happened. He died in 2006. The guy that followed him is now doing the same thing. And so you've got this problem of democracy as an idea and as implemented is unique to America. It's very, very new in human history. And the idea of free speech is solely and exclusively an American idea, in that it's your First Amendment. And then, of course, the founding fathers knew how easily that could be threatened by these powerful people.
Sure.
And so they put the Second Amendment in to defend the First Amendment.
That's right.
And the Second Amendment was to defend the people against their own government, not an external government.
Yeah.
Right? And one of the things people don't realize about the Second Amendment is that it also says that citizens must provide billeting for a militia army. That's part of the Second Amendment. Well, what's the militia army for? Well, it's to stop your government running roughshod over you. And so then the other thing that was important in the American Revolution was the private ownership of land.
Yes,
and you see that battle going on in the U.S. now,
yes,
with the Bundys and all of that stuff.
Yep, absolutely. And that is really, I think, at the heart of the discussion,
yep,
of socialism. All right, we are coming up on a break here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Dr. Tim Ball talking about what the Republicans ought to be talking about, socialism. And welcome back to the Nice Power Radio Show. Talking today again about socialism. This is a follow-up from a show a couple of weeks ago, but we're talking with Dr. Tim Ball, a retired professor from the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. And, you know, going into the break there, we're talking about this notion of private property, which I think is really foundational to so much of what the American founders did. And just to build on that, you know, we were talking earlier where Europe, you know, because they had the monarchs, maybe they were a little more prone to socialism and whatnot. But in America, you had this notion that there was this land out there that all you had to do was go out and make something of yourself. And that could not happen without the notion of private property.
That's right. Exactly. And, of course, just to illustrate that point, and we'll come back around to this, in Canada, land that isn't owned by anybody is called Crown land. That's the term. You call it federal land. Here, it's called Crown land. It belongs to the Crown. Right? So it just shows the hangover from the British Empire.
Now, does she pay taxes on that?
No.
No, I know.
Yeah, but getting the value of that land, of course, is one of the interesting things.
Yes.
Because, of course, governments don't budget like anybody else.
No.
And one of the things they don't do is count assets. And if you start counting the assets of a country in terms of its resources, and you look at Canada, I mean, Canada used to list Saskatchewan, which, by the way, is twice the size of Texas. It used to list it as what we call a have-not province. That is that its economy wasn't very good, and therefore it got transfer payments from the other provinces. It's a built-in socialism. But you look at Saskatchewan, they've got more tar sands than Alberta. They've got more oil than virtually any country in the world. They've got uranium, enormous amounts of uranium, coal, wood, water. In other words, they've got virtually every resource that every other country in the world would like, but we call it a have-not province. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But back to the idea about the private ownership of land, and of course, I think that the American Revolution was a people's revolution that the people that had come from Britain in particular had always wanted to have but were never able to have, and that opportunity was afforded them in America. Very few countries in Europe have ever had popular revolutions. The French Revolution was unique, and it came about, as I said, because there was a total harvest failure. Two consecutive years where bread went from being 55% of a total yearly income of the peasants, and then the second harvest failure, which was caused, by the way, by a volcanic eruption in Iceland, and it caused a cold, wet summers, and the harvest failed. But the second harvest failure summer, and Franklin predicted it, by the way, he said there's going to be harvest failures and problems in Europe. But the second summer, the French peasants were paying 85% of their total income just for bread.
Wow.
Nothing else. So, of course, at that point, they go through another harsh winter, and then in the spring, in June, they storm the Bastille and the French Revolution's on. But,
Well, I was going to say, in getting back to the American Revolution, of course, we had these monarchists, people that were still in favor of the British Crown, and after the Revolution happened, a lot of those fled to Canada. So why didn't some of those same ideas of private property, why didn't those then transfer up to Canada?
Well, because Canada was created by those people that saw what was going on in the U.S., decided that they didn't like it. They wanted a monarchy. They wanted to be for the crown. As you know, there were quite a lot of Americans who stayed in America and were that way for quite a while.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you got the Benedict Arnold stories and all the rest of it. But the group that moved to Canada are still around in Eastern Canada today. They have a name. They are the United Empire Loyalists.
Huh.
Okay, and that is a very large segment of the people that occupied Eastern Canada and formed Canada at the same time as the American Revolution was going on. Now, there were some groups of people that got caught, because whenever the parents are fighting, the innocent bystanders, the children, are the ones that suffer. And what happened in that battle, and of course it's mostly confined to Eastern North America, where you've got the 13 states and so on, but the Cajun people in Louisiana, who were of French origin, all right, they also got squeezed out, and a whole bunch of them moved up to Canada, into New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and they are now known in Canada as the Acadian people.
Yes, that's right.
Uh-huh. Okay? And they have their own unique language and their own cultural identity and everything else. So they were the ones, of course, the Indians were caught up in all of this and dealt with by being put onto reserves and simply isolated and you know, fenced off. And that's how they were dealt with. But the United Empire Loyalists moved into Canada, and they were the ones that formed Canada. And it was called Upper Canada at that time, but it represented the eastern part of what you know as Canada today. And there's some wonderful stories. I'll tell you one, just one quick one, because and there was a battle going on, of course, as to who could get the rest of North America. A lot of people don't know, but Jefferson had a standing order, and he was a continentalist, that he believed it was the manifest destiny of the United States to control the entire continent of North America for the American people.
That's right.
And so, all right, so anything that was published about North America, he wanted on his desk as quickly as possible. And a guy by the name of Alexander Mackenzie, who had worked for the Hudson Bay Company and then with the Northwest Company, and he was sent on an expedition up what is now the Mackenzie River to the Arctic coast. He came back to Fort Chippewyan in the Northwest Territories. He then was sent out to the west coast of Canada through the Fraser Canyon, and he arrived in 1789 on the west coast of what is now British Columbia, a place called Bella Coola. And he then went back to Fort Chippewyan. He's now an old man. He's 52. He retires to England. He publishes his journals of all of his expeditions and exploits, and that was his pension plan. And within 3 months of them being published, a copy was on Jefferson's desk. And Jefferson's reading this and saying, "We are being cut off on the West. Those darn Brits and that Hudson Bay Company are blocking any expansion of America to the Northwest." He goes down the hallway to stop it. He goes down the hallway and gets two guys by the name of Meriwether and Lewis and Clark.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, that was the trigger of the whole Lewis and Clark expedition
Well, I just could say, isn't that fascinating that was the impetus for it, is to head off the expansion of the former loyalists. All right, we are definitely up against a break here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more on socialism, seeing how we have a socialist running for our presidency. Stay with us. Lots more with Dr. Tim Ball. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Fascinating discussion today on some of the historical aspects behind the socialist movement. And, of course, we're seeing that now with Bernie Sanders and his rise to fame here. And unfortunately, just so many people just not aware of what that really means. And so we were talking with Dr. Tim Ball. He's a Canadian geographer and historical climatologist, best known for his public opposition to the so-called scientific consensus in the global warming controversy. And, you know, going into the break there, we're talking about private property and whatnot. And so you've got these loyalists that had moved up to Canada. And so the whole idea of socialism really developed out of and as a response to the enormous success and wealth being created in the Industrial Revolution. So now they wanted to make things more fair. They didn't want to necessarily cut off the wealth development, but they wanted to just spread that out, spread the wealth, so to speak, you know, even back then. So why is it that Canada, in looking at the wild success of private property and the embrace of the free market system down here in the U.S., why did they then want to emulate that?
Well, it's around the idea of immigration or emigration. One of the things that, and that relates to the nature of people, if you take 100 people, there's only 10 of them that will volunteer for leading or positions. And if you take that 10, there's only one or two of them that will then volunteer for the top positions. Mm-hmm. And I used to tell my students, you know, you can take over any group. Just volunteer to be on the executive, volunteer to be secretary, because nobody wants that, volunteer to be treasurer, because nobody wants that. Now you've got all the dirt on everybody, and you can get the presidency. So it's very easy to take over, because the majority of people do not want to have to be involved in decision-making. They're far happier deferring it to somebody else and accepting that there might that might create some awkwardness at times for them. They don't want to be leaders. And all of the studies done, as I mentioned, Ardrey's book on the alpha, you see it in animal packs, the alphas and omegas. For example, there's a marvelous documentary showing a herd of cattle, and they round them up and take them through a narrow chute. And as they go through, they put stickers on their backs of different colors. And the first 10, they put purple, and then so on. They then put them out in the field, mix them all up again, drive them back through the same fence they go through in the same order. In other words, there's the group that lead and the group that follow. Hmm. And of course, what happened was that those people that in the United States were basically given a choice. You can stay here and be part of the revolution and part of private ownership of land. But there was a large group of them that did not want that responsibility. They preferred to stick with the old system. Now, part of the reason is, as I said, the nature of human beings and the alphas and the omegas. But also, it's because people are afraid of change. They are very conservative about change because they know that change may be necessary, but when change occurs, there's winners and there's losers, and they might be the losers. So when you see revolution going on, you've got that problem. Now, when I talked about emigration, what was happening in Europe prior to the setup of the United States and so on was the climate was cooling down to the little ice age, harvest failures. For example, in 1688, we know from the church records of the churches that about two-thirds of the population starved to death in one winter.
Wow.
Now, those are conditions that we can't even imagine in Africa today, Garamantran. Okay? And then you think about the Irish potato famine as another example. In the Irish potato famine, the population of Ireland before the famine was 8 million. After the, 2 years after the famine, which lasted about 2 years, it was down to 4 million and really hasn't been above that since. But what happened to the 4 million that were gone? Well, 2 million of them emigrated to the United States, 2 million stayed behind and starved to death. And then of the 4 million that were left, another 2 million were quite badly malnourished. Okay? What the point I'm making about all of this is it takes a certain type of person to be a migrant.
Mm.
You've got to be willing to take risks. You want to be at the frontier. You want to look over the horizon.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've argued is that the United States was made up of a gene pool of people with those kinds of qualities, which is, of course, why the United States is willing to take chances. They're willing to try things. In fact, I was talking to somebody just before this program about the differences between Canadians and Americans. If you present an idea to an American, well, most of them, they'll say, hey, that's a good idea. We should try that. The Canadian response is, well, that's an interesting idea, but we've never done it that way before. And so the cultural difference is there.
Yeah.
Right? Now, one of the proofs of my argument is that people that are in the United States not by choice have a hard time fitting in. Right? And so what was going on with at the time of the formation of the Revolutionary War, of course, was there was a group that preferred the monarchy, didn't want private ownership of land, were quite comfortable to live on the Lord's estate. And you can see all of that, by the way, in Downton Abbey, the above stairs, below stairs. The people below stairs are quite comfortable in their quite restricted conditions, because
and there's that notion of safety too, that psychological safety is not just economic safety too. So
right, and it was
let me go ahead and interrupt you here. We are up against break here. Everyone, stay with us. We'll be wrapping things up with Dr. Tim Ball, talk about socialism. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Dr. Tim Ball. He's a retired professor from the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Canada. He taught climatology, geology, geography, and political science up there. And we've been talking about socialism. And going into the break there, we were talking about the real differences there between why Canada embraced the system that they did versus what we did here in America. And that really, as you put it, we have the gene pool here in the U.S. of these adventurers and leaders and people that really wanted to make something of themselves. So what do you think then, because you guys just had an election there for your prime ministers, so what do you think of the difference between what you saw there versus what you see here in the U.S. going on?
Well, of course, one of the primary differences is that you are seeing a presidential election. Every American citizen gets to vote for the person they want to be president. Yeah. We had a prime minister elected. I had no vote or say in who that was going to be.
That's right.
The prime minister is chosen from the political party that gets the most votes. Therefore, it's the political party that decides who will be the prime minister of Canada.
Yeah, and just to put that in perspective, that would be like us electing the House of Representatives, and John Boehner is the president. Imagine that.
Yeah, decided by the Republicans or the Democrats.
Wow.
And worse than that, and of course, by the way, that the party selecting the prime minister reflects the old aristocratic system that the aristocrats determined who the king would be. Mm-hmm. And even after the parliament was created, the House of Lords still had control over the parliamentary system, because the English aristocrats were always smart enough just to give a little bit, let the people think that they were in control when they really weren't. But to further emphasize that point about Justin Trudeau becoming our prime minister, his party won with only 39% of the vote. So his party doesn't even represent half of the people, and yet they got to choose who the prime minister would be.
Oh.
And of course, who did they choose? They chose the people opted for the party that was going to give them the most of the public's money.
Yeah, the bread and circuses.
And that goes back to a quote, and it's attributed to Lord Macaulay in 1857. He said, "A democracy cannot survive as a permanent form of government. It can last only until its citizens discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority who vote will vote for the candidates promising the greatest benefits from the public first, with the result that a democracy will always collapse from loose fiscal policy, always followed with a dictatorship."
Mm.
And of course, that's the situation that we constantly face here in Canada, and unfortunately seems to be the preferred direction in the United States right now.
That's very true. I mean, you certainly see that in the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats are out there making all those promises in terms of the giveaways versus the Republicans. No, we want to give you the opportunity to make something for yourself, and that is sometimes a very hard sell.
It's a very hard sell, and of course, so that's just the idea of who's going to be the leader of your country marks the huge difference between Canada and the United States and what's going on. I'll just finish up with one.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have time for that. But you know, this has been such a fascinating discussion. That we are absolutely going to have you back next week, because we didn't really get around to some of the personal experiences with what you guys are dealing with there.
Yeah.
And so we really do want that boots on the ground look in terms of what it's like to live in a socialist society like that. So I want to thank you so much for your time, and we will talk to you next week.
Lovely. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Bye-bye. You know, I always enjoy talking with Dr. Tim Ball, and next week, I hope that you're going to join us for that, because next week we'll be focusing on the policies and also his personal experiences to really understand what it's like to live with these different elements of socialism, what he's seen happening there in Canada over the years, especially with Canada's socialized medicine. And, of course, we now have Obamacare. And so what is it that we're headed for? It's important to combat this. And I do wish that the Republicans would be focusing more on their opposition. There are some polls right now showing not just that Sanders could win the nomination for the Democrats, but even possibly win the general election. Here in Oregon, socialism is also on the rise. The House just passed a huge increase in the state's minimum wage. And to get an idea of where that is headed, be sure to check iSpyRadio.com. We've got some links up there, some videos and some articles about basic income and also universal income explained. On that last one, there is no work requirement. Head to iSpyRadio.com for the links to that. And be sure to share them, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.